MechCast, Sunday, December 30th, 2018. Geeks, it's time for your MechCast, the show for Mech Geeks by Mech Geeks. I'm Adam, and this is the show where we discuss all things Macintosh. How you doing? Welcome back to the MechCast for the final MechCast of 2018. Yeah, 2018, not the final one. We've been doing this for many years now, about 14 plus years at this point, and I love hanging out with you each and every week talking about Apple and Mac stuff, and this week is no exception, even if it is the last week of the year. We'll be talking to you next time in 2019, and I hope you've had a great holiday season. I hope you have a wonderful, happy, and safe new year, and we'll talk to you on the other side, but we've got to get through this episode first, and it's a good one. I think we've got some good things to talk about, if not a little bit light. Yeah, here at the end of the year, there's not a lot going on, if I'm being really honest. I'm looking through the show notes. Didn't have a lot of stories to cover, but we have a few things to talk about. We're going to talk about iPad minis. I know a lot of you are very excited about that. We talked a little bit last week about what's happening there. We got a little more information this week. Not a ton, but a little bit more. We're going to get into Apple's current iPhone mix and a little bit about iPhone sales as they compare to 2017. We got a little numbers there. Some things going on with Apple and their manufacturing partners in India. And then I have some odds and ends is what I'm calling them, little tiny stories, you know, a little potpourri of things happening here at the end of the year. And then we're going to get into some of your feedback. We're going to do some follow-up on my question to you about Apple TV and games on Apple TV. And I'm even going to give you some of my favorite Apple TV games, because there's some good ones out there. And I think Apple TV gets overlooked a little bit as a gaming platform. We're also going to answer a question about video encoding and codecs. And we'll round it out with some Apple Music questions and a little AirPod app that you might be interested in, or more really a Bluetooth app that somebody recommended and I tried out and I thought was great. So that will round out this episode. I say let's just dive right in to some of the latest news. So told you last week that there were rumors resurfacing that Apple might be looking to update the iPad mini in 2019. It's probably going to happen sometime in the first quarter, probably some sort of spring announcement it's looking like. We had heard this from Ming-Chi Kuo in the past. It sort of resurfaced again through some other leaks and rumors. And then this week, or this past week, we had a little follow-up. Slash Leaks showed off a potential iPad mini case on Twitter with some new features in it. So it's looking like it's going to be an iPad mini 5 case. Don't know if it's something that's just being put together purely on speculation or what it might be, but it did show some interesting features, including an oblong camera cutout, just like the camera cutout on an iPad Pro, which would seem to indicate not a dual lens, but a True Tone flash, because the new iPads actually have a flash. And I'll tell you a funny story. Until I read about this rumor, I didn't realize my iPad Pro, my 11-inch, had a flash on it. I had no idea. I did go into the control center today and add the flashlight app to my iPad. I don't know how much I'll use it on my iPad, but it's cool that it's in there. Anyway, it's looking like the iPad Mini 5 may also get a flash, and I think that would make sense. The image also seems to show, although it was kind of hard to see, a headphone jack cutout, which to me dings the rumor a little bit. I think Apple is done with the headphone jack, although maybe they would keep it on an iPad Mini 5. Maybe. I don't know. I guess they did. They still have it on the 9.7-inch, right? So maybe it could still be there. And we are expecting that new model to drop in price, because the current iPad Mini 4 is $399 US. That's for the 128 gigabyte model. That's actually more expensive than the entry-level 9.7-inch iPad. Now, that's just 32 gigabytes, but it still seems like a weird discrepancy. So we're expecting them to bring the price down, maybe more into the $299 range, somewhere in the mid-$200 range, which I think would be a great price for an updated iPad mini. And I know a lot of you out there would jump on that iPad mini 5 at that price point. So glad to see that maybe Apple isn't done with the iPad mini. It was getting a little hairy there for a little bit. It looks like they're just going to be taking a long time between updates. And so hopefully we'll see something about that this spring. Consumer Intelligence Research Partner has been looking at the first 30 days of iPhone XR sales, and they're trying to glean basically how consumers are responding to the new model. And to do that, they are comparing it against the first 30 days of sales of the iPhone 8 series models. Now, if you remember, what Apple did was last year was the first year where they kind of had a premium new model, and then they had an older model or a different model that they were selling at a reduced price. And yes, they've always kind of done that in the past, but here was two kind of flagship models, right? They had a new iPhone 8 to replace the iPhone 7, and they also had the new iPhone 10. This year, we got a similar situation with the iPhone XS and then the iPhone XR filling in that spot for the iPhone 8. So it seems to make sense to compare those two models together. And they did note it was a little bit tricky because the launches were basically reversed. If you remember, in 2017, we got the iPhone 8 models first, and then the premium model, the iPhone X, was delayed. This year, it was flipped around. We got the iPhone XS and XS Plus first, and then the iPhone XR. But nonetheless, they looked at the numbers. They surveyed 165 U.S. customers, which, frankly, if I'm being honest, doesn't sound like a very good sample size to me, but we'll go with the numbers. They looked at those folks who purchased iPhone XRs in the first 30 days, and what they noted was that the iPhone XR, as a total part of the iPhone sales mix in that 30 days, accounted for about 32% of iPhone sales. Now, comparing that to the iPhone 8, 8 Plus in its first 30 days of sales in 2019, it captured about 39% of the total makeup. So it looks like the iPhone XR is not as popular as the iPhone 8 Plus was back in its day. They did note that the iPhone XR, though, did seem to pull in more switchers from Android. 16% of the customers surveyed said they were upgrading from an Android device to an iPhone XR. Back when the iPhone 8 series launched in 2017, it had about a 12% Android switcher rate, which that number actually surprised me a little bit because I would have figured, especially with the iPhone 8 Plus, that there would have been quite a few people coming over from Android at that point. And you wouldn't think the iPhone XR would be quite as compelling, although it is a 6.1-inch phone, so it is in that larger size factor. So maybe, you know, I don't know. All of this, though, I think should be totally taken with a grain of salt. But in looking at these numbers and sort of rates and stuff like that, it does seem more and more, this is just another bit of evidence, that this year's lineup of iPhones across the board are just not resonating with consumers, probably as much as Apple would have hoped. And I do think it's a little bit odd because overall, I think, especially with the iPhone XR, this is a pretty exciting year for iPhone models. Of course, pricing going up, I think, is ultimately hurting Apple the most. And I think we're seeing Apple respond to that. We're seeing carriers respond to that because if you've been watching sales and stuff for the past week, there's a lot of heavy promotion going on. Apple, we talked about last week, is giving larger incentives for trading in older phones. Prices are coming down. I think I saw an ad just tonight on when I was streaming something that the iPhone XR is at a special reduced price right now. And I think that's with the trade-in. I think there was a little asterisk on that. I didn't get into the nitty-gritty details. But we haven't seen Apple kind of doing those sorts of promotions in the past and promoting this heavily so close after a launch. So I think that does say something. Although this report still does note that demand for the iPhone XR is actually higher now than either the iPhone X or iPhone 8 was after their launch, 30 days after their launch. So there is some hope in there. The iPhone XR doing well. I think in the long run, the iPhone XR is going to really sell well with consumers. I think it's just not the kind of phone people are rushing in to get as an early upgrade. I think people are going to wait for their upgrade cycle to come, and I think iPhone XR will still be a choice for a lot of consumers. And so it doesn't surprise me that it is sort of making up a bigger part of the overall iPhone mix when buying iPhones. And I don't know. I've been trying to look and see if I've seen many in the wild. At this point, I don't think I really have, but I'm fully expecting to see more over the years. So I'm curious more to hear from you. I know those of us in the MacCast community, we have kind of all kinds of different phones. I think we could do a larger survey than even consumer intelligence research partners could. Can we get more than 165 people to write into me and say, you know, what kind of model they bought and what they think of it? Did you stick with your existing model? Did you buy a new model? If you did you buy a 10R? Did you buy a 10S? Did you go for an iPhone 8? I don't know. I'd love to kind of get a little informal MacCast survey and see how we do and see what people are thinking of this year's iPhone lineup. So shoot me your feedback. Send me your emails, maccast@gmail.com. One area we know Apple has been struggling a little bit with iPhone sales this year is in India, and that is almost certainly a direct response to the new higher prices. And one potential way around that is for Apple to maybe offer more options in India. And we did get some reports this week that it looks like Apple might be getting ready to do just that, because Foxconn is reportedly going to spend about $356 million US to expand their plant in India to allow for increased iPhone production. Currently, Apple does have iPhone production in India through one of Foxconn's competitors, Wistron, but they currently only do older and lower cost models, the iPhone SE and iPhone 6S, which is still produced in India, to sell into the India market, which is a little more price sensitive than some of Apple's other markets. The new Foxconn facility would likely be producing, they say, an iPhone 10. And yeah, I found that a little bit odd too. Not a 10S, but an iPhone 10, a more premium model. And it's believed that Apple might introduce the older model of iPhone at a more affordable price in certain markets like India. And so we have seen them do this in the past. China's a little bit price sensitive as well. I think Apple has some other markets, so they could be looking to produce that there. We have been hearing these reports that the models, the new models, the 10S, 10S Plus, are just not resonating with Indian consumers. So it seems like that would be a good move on Apple's part. The new plant and new production facility also could be coming to try to get ahead maybe of some of the trade sanctions and import taxes that might be coming on goods from China. That is something that is in flux right now. And so Apple's manufacturing partners could simply be looking to get manufacturing into countries outside of China to help, you know, their own bottom lines as well as, you know, helping out their customers. So I think I talked about this last time we talked about sort of the things that were going on in China, that you know, even if the trade sanctions come in, additional import taxes and all those sorts of things start to happen, what we really will see is just manufacturing moving to other countries where those sanctions don't exist. And India is a prime location for that. So I think there's no surprise that Foxconn is looking to do a little bit of expansion in their cell phone production areas outside of China. So, and they seem to be doing just that. Now let's get to those odds and ends I was telling you about. Starting off with Apple looking to add Sony chips potentially to their camera sensors, the Sony 3D sensor technology for the next iPhone. Now we've heard this before, that Apple is looking to add specifically to the iSight camera new 3D sensing systems so they can enhance the VR and AR applications in the iPhone. This would be the chips that do the time of flight 3D system, basically, you know, looking at images, sending information out, I think, with lasers, and then seeing how long that information takes to sort of bounce back, and then you can get a 3D depth map from those sensors and that technology. The technology would also enable you to do things like hand gestures, so gesture controls not touching the screen, something that I think Samsung experimented with a little while back. I don't think it stuck around for too long. But you could have virtual game controllers, gesture controls in games, which might be very interesting. But I think even more interesting, and probably what Apple is more interested in, is some of the virtual 3D AR VR applications, where you could actually have a 3D object generated, and it would be able, because of this technology, to move in front of and behind real objects in real time. So you can, you know, get a sense of distance. It would also help with probably some of the things like Apple's measure application. There's a lot of potential applications for this technology, and it looks like Apple might be rolling forward with that in future iPhones with sensors and chips from Sony. Another thing that's been going on and we've been talking about lately is the bend controversy on the new iPad Pros. It's something that appears to be happening to at least some consumers. Well, Best Buy put out a report this week on sales data of iPad Pros and how things are selling, and it doesn't appear that these reports of iPad Pros bending are having any effect, at least on sales at Best Buy, right? And it's kind of a narrow bit of information, but, you know, interesting nonetheless. It seems like consumers are not too worried about getting bent iPads, maybe. I don't know. I do have to say that I still find Apple's response to the whole bend issue, the stuff we talked about last week, to be pretty appalling. I will tell you, I have so far not heard from one listener in the MacCast community who has been impacted by this issue. I think I told you my 11-inch iPad Pro seems to be fine. I've been using it since I got it on launch day, and no bends here at all, at least not that I can tell, nothing that I can perceive. That's not to say that I don't believe it's happening. I do think that consumers, just based on the images and reports that we've seen online, I think there are consumers receiving iPad Pros out of the box that come bent from the factory. Now, I think it could be just maybe a single batch, some sort of fluke at one manufacturing location. Not really sure or clear what's going on. I'm sure, and I would hope, that Apple is investigating and looking into it, but their public response saying that iPads arriving with visible bends from the factory are, quote, normal, or, quote, within tolerance, that is ridiculous. That is just not the right way to handle it. We've been getting reports of people having to pay accidental damage fees to get replacements for bent iPads under AppleCare Plus. That kind of thing should not be happening. Apple should be taking care of these consumers. They should continue to investigate. They don't have to come out publicly and say anything, but just quietly and privately, they should be handling these things a little bit better. And I would love to know or hear from anybody, if you have received a bent iPad Pro from the factory out of the box, let us know how that happened, when you got it, what your experience has been in dealing with Apple. Did they take care of you? It literally should be you go into the store and they just replace it. Some consumers are able to replace it under the, you know, the free 14-day return policy, so just return it and then buy a new one. But you shouldn't even have to do that. You should be able to go in and say, look, I received this, look at it, here's what happened, and they should simply just be replacing it, no questions asked. And the fact that that's not happening is a little bit frustrating to me. But overall, again, as far as sales are going, it doesn't seem to be impacting it, although I think if Apple lets this story continue, it will start to impact sales, and people will just generally avoid this model iPad, because, you know, who wants a bent iPad, especially when you're paying the kind of money Apple wants you to pay for this sort of thing. So we'll keep following the story. We'll keep an eye on it. And we'll also, again, keep asking the community to let us know what their experiences are. You know, let's get to the front lines and figure out what's going on out there. Let us know, maccast@gmail.com. And then the last thing, something that also is a little bit frustrating, Netflix this week, it looks like, or this month, started to do away with in-app subscription purchases for Netflix subscriptions on their iOS app. That means that if you want to get a new Netflix subscription, you can't do it through an in-app purchase. You're going to have to go to the Netflix website and sign up for the service. Also, if you're resubscribing. Now, if you are already on a subscription, an in-app subscription through the Netflix app, you will continue to be able to use that until you cancel it. If you do cancel it and then try to resubscribe, you're going to have to go back through the website. And of course, this is the whole thing where basically companies don't like paying the in-app subscription fee that Apple charges. You know, Apple takes 30% on the first subscription, and then I think on renewals they take 15%, although I think we had heard a while back that Netflix had done a deal with Apple where they were just paying the 15% up front. I guess they don't want to pay that anymore and have pulled the feature from the app, which is unfortunate because I think it's a really great feature. I actually pay for my HBO subscription that way, and it is super convenient when I have to resubscribe or re-log in. Sometimes it times out. I can just basically have it validate my purchase through the App Store, and boom, I'm right back in. And I absolutely love it. I think it's a convenient way for consumers to purchase subscriptions through the app. And I think ultimately this kind of story ends up being a big problem for Apple, in my opinion, because it just shows that their partners, they're not willing to kind of play ball with them. And I think they need to be doing more to entice these companies or to support them to continue to use the in-app purchase model. And I don't know what the hang-up is. My one concern would be that maybe privacy, you know, the non-sharing of consumer data is a problem for these companies. And, you know, I wouldn't like to see Apple back down on that. So I understand Apple's position on this. If it's purely a monetary thing, though, if it's purely that subscription, you know, that in-app purchase rate, that percentage that Apple gets, especially for larger companies like Netflix or Amazon or HBO or these kinds of partners, I think Apple should be working a little bit more with them to get the rate into an area that everybody could live with, where Apple's not hurting, you know, they're not losing money off of it, but they're still making something, and where consumers can still benefit from the convenience of the features. So can they reach that resolution? I don't know. Hopefully they're still talking about it, and hopefully at some point these in-app purchase subscription things start to come back to some of our favorite applications and services, because again, I find them really convenient. If the HBO version went away, I wouldn't stop subscribing to HBO, but it would be a little bit of a hassle, and I wouldn't like it as much. So I don't know. What do you think about this stuff? Shoot me some feedback and emails, maccast@gmail.com. But as I said, a little bit light on the news this week. That is going to do it. Before we move on, I do want to take a quick moment and thank one of my show sponsors, and that is OpsGenie by Atlassian. You know, we really hate it when our favorite website or service goes down, even for just a minute. We were talking about Netflix there. If Netflix goes down, it's a problem for me. If I can't make a purchase on Amazon, yeah, I'm not happy. I don't like it when iCloud goes down. It makes me not a happy customer. But that unhappiness that I feel is nothing compared to the impact that this has on businesses. When their services go down, that's money for them. It costs them. But luckily for them, they have a bunch of unsung heroes, their dev and ops teams. Those are the guys who swoop in and they save us from those outages. And if you're one of those folks on a dev or ops team, then luckily for you, there is OpsGenie from Atlassian, because it's your job to respond quickly to incidents. And for that, you'll want a tool like OpsGenie in your utility belt, because OpsGenie gives your team the power to respond quickly and efficiently to these unplanned issues. It helps you notify all the right people through a smart combination of scheduling and escalation paths that take into account things like time zones and holidays. It also allows for deep flexibility in how, when, and where your alerts are deployed, and it's supported by over 200 integrations like Jira, Amazon CloudWatch, Datadog, New Relic, and more. And best of all, it tracks all of that activity and provides useful insights to help you improve future incident responses. With OpsGenie, your next incident doesn't stand a chance. To try out OpsGenie at your organization, visit opsgenie.com to sign up for a free company account, and you can add up to 5 team members completely free. Never miss a critical alert again with OpsGenie, and a huge thank you to OpsGenie and Atlassian for their support of the MacCast. On the last episode, we were talking a little bit about the Apple TV, and specifically about games on the Apple TV, and how the Apple TV seemed like it could be a really great gaming platform, maybe something that could serve as a console for those of us who are maybe more a little bit into casual games. And there was a little bit of disappointment from not only me, not only the community, but also myself in how Apple TV has panned out for games. I think there's still some great opportunities there, but it seems more and more like developers aren't taking advantage of that. Every once in a while, we'll see a cool little title. But more and more, we're seeing things like My Minecraft or Disney Infinity going off of the Apple TV platform. And so the question was, you know, should Apple be doing more? And I kind of think the answer is yes, for developers to try and entice them into the Apple TV platform. But I asked for some feedback from the community. I asked for you to chime in, and I did get a response this week. We heard back from listener Gary, and I can think of no better person to have on the final episode of the MacCast for this year. So here's what Gary had to say about Apple TV and games.
Happy New Year, Adam. I wanted to give you some feedback on the state of Apple TV and gaming on there. I did purchase the Disney Infinity when it first came out, and I had quite a lot of characters and played those games on there, and it was fun. It was sad to see it go. The state of it right now, probably the most exciting game that I play on there is the Asphalt 8 racing game, and I think it does a really nice job on the Apple TV. It was a purchased game, I believe, when I first got it, and it has had updates since then, and it just has been free. I know there's in-app purchases that many people probably purchase to buy cars to upgrade them. I generally just do it at the pace of what I can earn in the game. The Apple TV remote really does a nice job with this game. I've tried it with the Nimbus controller, and it's not a good fit. It doesn't have the gyroscopic control of the car. Other games on the Apple TV that I've found is really great are team party games, like part of the You Don't Know Jack series, and there's been a couple other ones that have been fun to play as a group. But the majority of all the other games are not compelling enough to play. And in general, there's not enough, I think, controls on the Apple TV to make it a good gaming system. I found that many times I'm in a game and I'm racing or doing something, and I accidentally hit like the menu or the TV button, and then I get disconnected, and all of a sudden I'm lost the race or whatever it is. So that's been frustrating. Not sure if that's not really why the platform isn't maybe successful, but it's a problem for me, and maybe it's a problem for others. I think that Apple could do more with developers extending that ability to store large games on it. So if you have something super awesome and you've got room on your Apple TV, you can store it. If not, maybe there is an opportunity to store some of it in the cloud. I do know that one of the other frustrations for me is, where does my game get saved? And it's still a problem on the Apple TV when you have a multiple Apple ID household. One person is like the iCloud holder. There's another person for the iTunes store. There's maybe another person can be the game center and where your game gets stored. So a lot of the storage of the data for whatever game you have gets stored in those areas. And if somebody logs you out or you get logged in as another person, your game can get erased and you can't easily take it with you wherever you go. Like where a normal game platform, you might be able to take your character to that next gaming system and play it somewhere else. So that's been my experience on the Apple TV and gaming. Thanks, Adam.
Hey, thanks, Gary. I love hearing your opinion on this stuff, and I'm in agreement with a lot of the things you had to say there. I think that's a great point that I didn't mention the last time about multi-user households, and really your Apple TV is still a single-user platform, right? So if I have my games on there and I have my game data, it's really tied into my iCloud account and my Game Center account and nobody else's, and there is no really easy way to switch back and forth between multiple people. So, you know, potentially your game data gets messed up. If you're trying to make progress in a certain title, yeah, then someone else wants to come in and play that title. You know, hopefully the game itself has the ability to have multiple saved games and you can handle it that way, but then they still don't sync across to other people's devices, however it might be. So yeah, there's a lot of room for improvement, and I think that's maybe where some of the frustration comes in, because Apple has sort of thrown it out there. They positioned it as a gaming platform a few generations back, and then haven't really nurtured it very much, right? They haven't done much for developers beyond maybe inviting a few on stage to show off the latest, greatest game. There's a new game coming out, I think they just showed off, that looks amazing, called Sky. And I hope that's something that still does happen. It looks like it's coming in 2019, and I'm looking forward to that. But it will also be available on iOS. And I think what's happening is a lot of us see what's available on the Apple TV and how it plays, and ultimately end up playing it just on our devices, on our phones or our iPads. But, you know, I will say there are still some great games out and some great gaming experiences on the Apple TV. And so I wanted to extend this conversation because you mentioned one of those games that I had kind of forgotten about and I really, really loved as well, which was Asphalt 8. It is a great driving game and it is a great experience on the Apple TV. It's also really fun to do multiplayer. So we do that in my house. My kids get on their iPads or iPhones. I play on the Apple TV or vice versa, however it might be, and we can all race together. I think up to four people locally, you can get into a race. And of course, there's online racing as well, so you can race, you know, other people online. But great racing platform, great graphics, looks great on the Apple TV. And so I thought, you know, I should go through and mention some of my favorite Apple TV games. I'm not going to get into a lot of detail on each one of these because there's quite a few of them, but I'll give you a little overview of one or two and tell you why I like them. Lumino City is a great, beautiful game. It's sort of like not really an RPG, but it's one of these where you've got little puzzles, you walk around to different areas. But what's really amazing about it is it looks like a 3D graphics game, but all of the backgrounds and locations and scenes and things like that were built out of paper. It was all paper folding, paper construction kinds of scenes. And it's just a really beautiful kind of puzzle adventure game. And I absolutely loved playing that. And it plays great on the Apple TV up on a big screen. Leo's Fortune was one of my favorite games. It's kind of a side scroller, really, really fun game. Great, plays great on the Apple TV. Something else that's very similar to Leo's Fortune, although it is cat themed, is called The Big Journey. That's really fun. Of course, Crossy Road, which is your, you know, modernized Frogger knockoff is what I like to call that one, you know, trying to get across the road. It's kind of like an endless runner sort of game. If you've played that on the iPad with Apple TV, they added this great battle mode. So if you have two players playing, you can kind of try and push someone into the road. And we have a lot of fun with that one. For party games, you mentioned the Jackbox party games. Those are great. I'll also throw in Sketch Party TV, which is like a Pictionary kind of game for the Apple TV. And that's really fun, especially with an iPad Pro and an Apple Pencil. You get on there and people can do drawing and you're trying to guess up on the Apple TV. It's great when you have a bunch of people in your house and have a party. Transistor, which is a really, really great sort of top-down RPG-style action game. Again, beautiful, beautiful graphics. I really enjoyed playing that game. So there's just like a handful of really great games to try out on the Apple TV. There's also been several that I haven't had an opportunity to try out yet, but they keep showing up on sort of best of Apple TV lists, and they all look beautiful and great. A game, I guess, that came out this year is called Inside, and it's been available on other platforms, but came to the Apple TV, I think, in 2017 or 2018. That one is definitely on my list to give a try. If you have played that game and want to give us a little review for the MacCast, it'd be great if you could send that in. Shoot me an email or an audio comment would be even better. MacCast@gmail.com. Keep it to about 3 minutes if you send in an audio review, and I'd love to play that on a future episode. So the game is called Inside, probably also available on just iOS. Rayman Adventures, if you're a Rayman fan, that is supposed to be a lot of fun. Also, Oceanhorn looks beautiful. Another game I've been really wanting to try out. It's in that genre that I think I would really enjoy. And also, Geometry Wars 3 is supposed to be a really great playable game on the Apple TV. So there's just a few that I've heard about or I've personally tried. Like I said, I'd like to throw this out to the community. If you have an Apple TV game that you really enjoy playing and want to give us a little review or an audio comment, shoot me an email. MacCast@gmail.com. And I look forward to receiving those, and we'll try to share some of them on future episodes because I'd love to play more games on my Apple TV. Next up, we're going to get into a little bit of video encoding. Don't worry, we're not going to get too geeky, but this came up this week because listener Jim sent me an email, and he had been using the new version of Handbrake. If you don't know what Handbrake is, it's basically a video encoding application for the Mac, one of the better ones. And he noticed that there was a couple new presets in the new version of Handbrake, specifically for H.265 video. And you probably know what H.264 video is. You may know what H.265 is, but Jim didn't, and he had this question. He was saying, hey, I've been using the Super HQ 1080p 30 preset, but when I got this new version of Handbrake, I switched over to start using the Apple 2160p 60 4K HEVC preset. And when I did, I ended up with a file that was significantly smaller. And in the age of SSDs and smaller drives maybe coming on our Macs, the idea of having smaller files at a good quality is appealing. And I would agree with that, Jim. And so his question was, you know, what is H.265 and what are the advantages of using H.265? So we'll just try to answer it from a really high level. If you want to get into a lot of the technical nitty-gritty, a quick Google search on H.265 will, you know, bring you all kinds of details. If you want me to get into deeper details to the technical stuff here on the MacCast, I'd be happy to do so, but I have a feeling if I did too much of it, I'd just probably bore everybody. So HEVC might also be something that you've heard, or high efficiency video coding. That's what Apple likes to call this. It's also known as H.265 for videos. And it is just a video encoder, video compression. It's basically the successor to H.264, which many of us know. A lot of our files have been encoded in H.264. The big advantage, as you discovered, Jim, is that you get much smaller file sizes and you get higher quality video. So you can get higher quality video, smaller file sizes. Of course, like all encoding, you know, sort of what you're putting in and how you're tweaking it and what you're trying to get out affects those file sizes and qualities and things like that. But overall, as a general thing, as a general rule, HEVC or H.265 promises about a 50% storage reduction over video at the same resolution and quality as H.264. So it's about 50% more efficient, I guess is how you would probably say it. And so consequently, you can get things like 4K streaming at very high quality using this codec. It's very efficient. It does a bunch of different things. Again, very technical in a lot of ways, but has enhancements and improvements over H.264. And the only other thing you kind of need to know about H.265 is that if you want to actually create it or encode it, it has to do some pretty heavy number crunching. So for those of us on our devices, because newer devices will actually record H.265 or HEVC. Also, you might have heard of high efficiency image format or HEIF. New devices are also taking still photos in the new format. And that's a similar thing. It's sort of a image format to improve upon JPEG compression. So you get higher quality images, larger sized images at a smaller file size. So it's the equivalent of HEVC or similar to HEVC, but for still images. But regardless, you need a newer iPhone or iPad to be able to create images in that format or videos in this format. So for H.265, you need an iPhone 7 or later series phone. You would need an iPad 6th generation or newer, or an iPad Pro, the newer models, the 10.5-inch, the 11-inch, or a 12.9-inch 2nd generation or newer. So if you have a 1st generation 12.9-inch iPad Pro, that is not going to be able to do the H.265 video. So that's for creating the video. Now, actually playing back video, support for high efficiency video codec, HEVC, is actually built into, or was built into iOS 11. It was also built into Mac OS High Sierra and later. And in most cases, you would be able to, on a device that runs iOS 11 or Mac OS High Sierra, you would be able to actually play back H.265 video without an issue. Now, if you do have an older device, because H.265 is pretty intensive in terms of the processing, some devices can't support the higher quality 4K 2160p 60 frame per second video. They'll only be able to do the 1080p 30 frames per second. And I think probably the most significant one people need to know about is the Apple TV 4. So if you have an Apple TV 4, not a 4K, but the original 4, it will do high efficiency video codec HEVC playback or H.265 playback, but only at a 1080p resolution running at 30 frames per second. If you want to do the higher quality, the 2160p 60 frames per second, which I think is what you had said you had switched to, Jim, just note that that is not going to be able to be played, that it will not be able to be played back on an Apple TV 4. You will need an Apple TV 4K or better to be able to play back that video. So I don't know what kinds of devices you're attempting to play that back on. Now, again, in terms of your iPhones and your iPads and your Macs and things like that, if those can run iOS 11 or later and Mac OS High Sierra, and they're relatively newer devices, you're probably not going to run into any issues with the 2160p 60 60 FPS video. But just note, if it doesn't play back, then likely the problem is that you would have to encode at the lower 1080p resolution, 30 frames per second, still using the HEVC codec. So you can get that better compression, you can get that storage savings, but you might not be able to do it at as high a quality as you would like, depending upon the devices that you're sending it to. So we're kind of in that transition period, just like we had back in the day with H.265, right? Or 264, excuse me. For a while, not everything could play that back. So hopefully that gives you a good overview there, Jim, of H.265 and the new video codec. If you have additional questions, feel free to write in again. Also, if just any of you out there want to add to this conversation or have additional questions, shoot me an email, maccast@gmail.com. Now I want to move into a little bit of music stuff, and also just a little tip or trick, or a few tips or tricks on saving some storage space on your Mac, specifically with regards to Apple Music and iTunes. Because Bob wrote in this week, and he was doing some cleaning up on the hard drive of a MacBook Air that didn't have a ton of storage. I can't remember if it was a 128 or a 256, but it had gotten full. He said he was down to about 10 gigabytes of free space, and he was trying to clean things up, and he was going through his music library, so his iTunes media folder, and he noticed even after deleting a bunch of Apple Music stuff that there was still not as much free storage as he would have thought. So he started poking around in the folder and he ran across the Apple Music folder. So if you've ever looked in your iTunes media folder, you're probably familiar with a lot of the folders that are in there. You have movies, you have TV shows, you have music, and that's typically where all your iTunes music lived in the past, and even Apple Music in the early days. But now there is a new Apple Music folder. And what Bob had discovered was that there was a lot of files in there. And he realized, well, these are Apple Music folders. I subscribed to Apple Music, so I could just potentially re-download these things. And he basically just emptied out that folder and got a lot more storage space on his MacBook Air. Now, he did have a question about how those files got there. He was feeling like maybe it was just through using Apple Music and actually playing the music. Maybe somehow they automatically downloaded there. Bob, I'll tell you that typically shouldn't happen. There are, though, a couple ways that that music will end up in that Apple Music folder. So I wanted to go over that. one thing that you might want to do is double check your settings inside iTunes. So if you go into iTunes, go into the preferences and click on the downloads tab, you probably want to make sure, especially on any machine where you're worried about eating up storage space with music or files just in general from iTunes, you might want to check and make sure that you don't have the automatic downloads options checked for, say, music, movies, or TV shows. Because what'll happen here is when those are checked, anything that you add to your iTunes, your iCloud music library, excuse me, will automatically be downloaded to that Mac. And that would include anything that you add to your library from Apple Music. So if you go into Apple Music, you're browsing around and you click on that little plus or add button and you have automatic downloads checked in that download section, it will automatically download that music and put it into your Apple Music folder. So I have a feeling maybe that's what happened to you. You also, if you're using that setting, might want to double check the add songs to library when adding to playlists option. That is under the general tab in the preferences. If both of those are checked and you're adding music from Apple Music to a playlist, because that's checked, it says add songs to your library when you're adding them to the playlist. If then automatic downloads when adding music to your library is checked on as well, then again, those files will all start to get downloaded from Apple Music and stored onto your device. So they won't be streamed anymore. So I'll tell you personally, I have both of these options unchecked in my preferences, and that way, no matter what I do with Apple Music, whether I'm adding things to a playlist or I'm saying, hey, add this to my library, yes, it's adding it to my library, but it's not downloading the file locally. I can still play it in my library as streaming, but it's not going to be eating up that storage space, and it won't show up inside that Apple Music folder. So I have a feeling that's how that stuff got in there, and you might want to just double-check those settings and see what you have them set to, because otherwise you might see that folder start to fill back up even though you've emptied it and saved yourself all of that space. Now, that's not to say that Apple Music doesn't do some caching, because it actually does. As you're streaming stuff, it actually does download things into a special area on your Mac, and this is another area you might want to check and see if it's got a lot of storage in there. I went and poked around in my iTunes Apple Music cache folder, and I only had about 1.95 gigabytes of data. So not a ton, but not insignificant either. You can find the caches in the library folder inside your home folder. So you go to your home folder, to the library folder. Remember, if you're not seeing that, you can go under the Go menu, hold down the Option key, and you'll see library pop up there. You can also go to the Finder preferences of your home folder. You know, so when you're in your home folder, go into the Finder, go into the Finder preferences, and you can check the box that says to show the library folder, which is normally hidden. But go in your home folder, go in the library folder, and there's a caches folder inside there. And then inside that, there should be a folder called com.apple.itunes. And if you look at that, there's lots of stuff in there, including caches for recommendation data, for the For You data, and things like that. But what you're looking for are two specific folders. FS Cached Data is one of them, and that's going to have cached album artwork for streaming songs and items in the For You section. And there's also one called Subscription Play Cache, and that is the bigger one. That's going to be the caches of all the streamed songs that you've been playing. So if you've been playing a lot of music on your Mac, that Subscription Play Cache folder might be pretty large. And so these two folders you can actually safely remove, and what'll happen is next time you're running iTunes, they'll just get recreated and the caches will start to be rebuilt. So if that is filling up and taking up a lot of space, that is another area you could potentially clean up for Apple Music. Now, you might be asking yourself, well, what if I want to clean up those same caches on iOS? Unfortunately, there's not a folder or any place that you can go to. The only way to clear out caches, the Apple Music caches on iOS, is to actually turn off iCloud Music Library in your settings, music. So you have to toggle it off, wait a few minutes for iOS to kind of clean out and reclaim the storage space used by the caches, and then you can turn that setting back on again, and it will sort of reset all of that. So that's how you do it on iOS and macOS, and hopefully that helps some of you out with your Apple Music storage. And thanks, Bob, for sending in your comments and your questions. All right, last thing that I have for you is a little app that Andrew wrote in and told me about. And this started with him saying, hey, you know what? I love my AirPods. I love using them with my Mac and with my iOS devices. But I find that switching back and forth, especially connecting them to my Mac, it's not as great an experience as I would really like. It's not quite as easy as doing it on iOS. And I totally agree with that. Anybody who has AirPods and has connected them to iOS devices versus the Mac, you know, it's a little bit more cumbersome. On the Mac, you have to, you know, especially if you've had them connected to another device, you have to go into the Bluetooth menu, you have to select the AirPods, and then you have to click connect, and sometimes it doesn't always work. You might have to do it twice. And it just seems odd because, you know, you might be sitting there in front of your Mac, you have the screen open, you have your AirPods in, your iPhone is completely asleep, but it's still trying to stay connected or still connecting to the iPhone and not your Mac. And it feels like it should be more automated. And so that was sort of what Andrew was feeling. But in his email, he told me about a great Mac app that he found called Tooth Fairy. And I will link to this in the show notes at maccast.com, but you can find it on the Mac App Store. Tooth Fairy, what it does is it lets you add icons to your menu bar for Bluetooth devices that are connected to your Mac. And this would include your AirPods or third-party headphones or really any Bluetooth device. But in the case of AirPods, what's cool about it is it lets you just click that icon and then it automatically starts connecting to that device. So you don't have to go into the Bluetooth menu, scroll down or select down, find the AirPods, then click connect. You just simply click the little icon that you've now added to your menu bar, and it automatically switches over magically just with one click. And better than that, Tooth Fairy will actually let you set up a keyboard shortcut, a universal hotkey that you can just press. So like I set mine to Control Option Shift A for AirPods, and it automatically switched right to my AirPods. I tried it out. It worked brilliantly. Great little app. It's $2.99 in the Mac App Store, but it's also part of Set App. So if you have a Set App subscription, you can get it for free. It also has some advanced features, including the ability to run shell scripts on connect and disconnect for Bluetooth devices. I can't think of an application right now, but I would imagine some of you power users out there might want to do additional things when you're connecting a set of Bluetooth devices, right? So you connect Bluetooth headphones, maybe you want to launch another application, maybe you want to do some other things in the background. You can set all of that up with this little application. So great little application, really handy if you have a set of AirPods, but like I said, works with any Bluetooth devices, so might be something you want to check out. And thank you, Andrew, for sending in that tip. I really do appreciate it. But with that, that is going to do it for this episode of the MacCast. Before I leave you, I do want to take a quick moment and thank my show sponsor, Smile, makers of Text Expander, PDF Pen, also Text Expander for iPhone and iPad, PDF Pen for iOS, and PDF Pen Scan Plus. You can get more information and details on all of their great applications by visiting smilesoftware.com/podcast. Bandwidth for the MacCast is provided by CacheFly. You can find them at cachefly.com. And all advertising on the MacCast is handled by Backbeat Media. They are at backbeatmedia.com. as always, if you have a comment, a question, something you'd like to hear covered on a future episode of the MacCast, you're welcome to send me your emails and audio comments to maccast@gmail.com. You can also call in on the listener hotline, that phone number, 281-622-4269, 281-MAC-IM-9. And if you need show notes, links to anything that I talked about on this or any other episode of the MacCast, you'll find those on the website. That's at maccast.com. And if you'd like to follow me on social media, you can find me on Twitter, twitter.com/MacCast, or check out the MacCast Facebook page over at facebook.com/TheMacCast. But that is going to do it for the MacCast for 2018. I look forward to seeing you in the new year. Again, have a happy and safe new year. Look out for each other out there. But that is going to do it for now. Until next time, I will talk to you all again real soon.